This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. We should really just spend the whole pod discussing injury time at Spurs and Atleti. Absolutely hilarious slash frustrating endings, depending on who you support and whether you like VAR or not, and whether you know the laws of football. Harry Kane's late winner would have put Spurs through against Sporting, but it's not to be, and they have to get something in Marseille next week. It is worth asking again why they don't bother playing until the second half. At the Wanda, Atleti get a dodgy penalty after full time to keep their Champions League hopes alive. They miss it, miss the rebound, and then miss that rebound. Extraordinary. Elsewhere, Liverpool booked their place in the last 16 with an ultimately straightforward win at Ajax, while Rangers are on course for the worst group stage performance ever. Bayern Munich are better than Barca, who've accidentally pulled the Europa League lever. Elsewhere, Australia are the first country at the World Cup to really call for lasting change in Qatar, and the Aguero shirt is up for sale. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, welcome.
Morning.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
And hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Good morning, Max.
So let's start then at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs won, Sporting Lisbon won. Harry Kane scoring with 15 seconds left of injury time, a four-minute VAR check, an offside. Adam says, I'd like to hear Larry Silverton's take on the Kane offside and the fact that players, commentators don't seem to be well-versed in the rules of their profession. Meanwhile, AG 82653288 says, you're a journalist, and you don't investigate the rules? Look it up, mate. Spend tomorrow doing it and apologise for your stupidity. Kane is onside by the rules. The VAR ref's made an error. Call it out.
With apologies to the angry boss in question, I mean, that isn't exactly accurate, is it? Listen, I would usually on this occasion sort of get up on my high horse and bang my drum and go, oh, learn the laws of the game, bozos. But in fairness, I think this was a sufficiently unusual situation that I kind of want to give people slack for not being entirely clear. Now, mainly just because I'm very egotistic and self-centered person, and I was kind of confused. And if I was confused, then everyone must be confused, because this is how the world works. But I definitely had to double-check the laws of the game and fire off a DM to my refereeing acquaintance and ask, hang on, just to make double sure what laws applied, and because you just don't see it, because it's an instinctive thing, the thing with the ball being played backwards. It's such a sort of, it's right, and we're so used to that, well, it can't be offside then, because I mean, that's just kind of how geometry works. If the ball is played backwards and ends up with the guy, then they can have been in front. But of course, it was the deflection from the defender, and yeah, no, it was offside. So I guess there are, as always with these things, there are separate discussions taking place. One thing is, the goal was offside. It was very understandably missed by the officials in real time, but VAR cleared it up, so justice was done. Sporting nearly had a point taken off them by a refereeing mistake, but VAR rectified it. But it is obviously very unsatisfying, I think, for everyone to have a match end like this. I don't think anyone really enjoys that happening, whether you're pro or anti VAR. So on an emotional level, you know, I completely get the people who feel that this is just wrong and this is not what the sport should be about. I'm very sympathetic to that argument.
I think, Nicky, you sent a tweet which I thought was really interesting, and it does sort of, it does split between the match-going fan and if you're watching on television, right? You're watching the goal show on BT. And actually, when that is happening at Spurs and you have what's happening at Atleti, it's actually like brilliant television, right? It's hilarious, it's ludicrous. If you don't have a dog in the fight, or you're not so exercised about football that it defines how you feel for the next 2 weeks, it's brilliant entertainment. If you're in the ground, it's really annoying.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, I was sort of not meaning to diminish anyone's feelings about it. I was just sort of reflecting, because I'd been watching more of the Napoli game, but switching over to the goal show at the end of the night, and it was kind of perfect timing, because you had these two moments of high drama happening. You had half of their studio watching one of them, half of them watching the other one. Both ends are sort of whooping and shrieking as things are happening in real time, and it's dramatic telly, and that doesn't mean that it's right. That doesn't mean that that's what I think is good for football. I'm just saying that there's this contrast, because I've been in those stadiums, and when you're inside the stadium and you're waiting and sitting and standing and just nothing's happening. It's incredibly frustrating. And this isn't an original thought. I still don't understand why in football they can't, and I know people will get angry because VAR itself feels to a lot of people like something that was borrowed from American sports that was bad. But if you're going to do it, if you're going to have VAR, why can't you do what happens in American sports more often, where the referee, after a decision gets made, steps up onto the microphone and says, this is why the decision was made? Because I think another element of the frustration that happens inside the stadium is no one gets an explanation. Like, you just get, this is a goal, this isn't a goal, or this is a penalty and we're all coming back onto the pitch, as happened at Atletico. No one clarifies things for you. And I think as a fan inside the stadium, that's such a frustrating experience.
I would argue that, I'm not saying that shouldn't happen, but I think even if it did happen, people still wouldn't accept the explanation.
That's probably true.
Because at the end of the game last night, you had the referee explaining to Eric Dier and other Spurs players why it was offside, and all he was getting was Eric Dier screaming, but it went backwards, but it went backwards in his face. And even on watching it unfold on Twitter, where, what is it? Dale Gordon is a Norwich centre forward.
He's also the VAR expert. Yeah.
I was actually thinking, am I getting Dale Gordon? Is that the woman from Flash Gordon, or that's Dale Arden? So anyway,
Dale Johnson.
Apologies, Dale.
Dale.
So Dale Johnson was very, very patiently explaining exactly why the decision had been made and why it was correct. And there were still Tottenham fans, like, not only saying he was wrong, but abusing him and accusing him of being an Arsenal fan. For the record, Dale is a Sheffield Wednesday fan, I believe. But so even if you do get a calm, reasoned explanation, there are still, and I think you should, there will still be tens of thousands of people who won't have it. They won't agree with it.
I did think there was a particular sort of extra like element of what Baz is talking about in that Tottenham sort of scene that was happening. Because, look, before VAR, you still got decisions that upset players and players would surround a referee and shout at them, right? Like, that's not new. And I've always felt like there's a certain sort of futility in that, because a referee never goes, oh, you know what, you're right, I'm changing my mind. But you understand it because there's this moment of emotion and everyone's sort of boiled up and has to sort of let that out somewhere. But it felt like, because this one was such a long one in the Tottenham game, like the VAR just amplifies and exacerbates that in such an unhealthy way for everyone on the pitch. Like, everyone is sort of venting and he's there going, listen, I'm waiting for someone to tell me something in my earpiece. And there's just more and more space for that anger to boil up, and then when a decision does get made, inevitably that anger is at an even higher level.
When I was captaining my amateur team, there was a player who'd get angry all the time and join in fights. So as soon as there was any kind of melee, I would make him, he had to sit down on the ground cross-legged, fingers on hips, otherwise I just wouldn't pick him. And it really worked. So maybe all the players should have to sit down, fingers on lips. I do wonder if, I still think, though, and I said this, and I still think that if the VAR decision ultimately goes your way, fans don't care. So I think about Tottenham at Man City in that Champions League game when Sterling was just offside and City scored and they all celebrated and there was this massive delay, and then it was offside by, you know, Sterling's heel or whatever, and Spurs fans were delirious. I think about when Cambridge scored against Newcastle in the FA Cup. They scored, all the fans in the ground celebrated. Then there was like a 4-minute VAR check, and then the goal was given, so they celebrated again, right? So basically, it's just, if it goes for you, even if there is a long delay, it's great. And if it goes against you, it's bad. And that's sort of like life, isn't it? It's just life. It's like, if it's good, it's good. And if it isn't, it isn't. And I know some people hate it and some people love it and you may never fix it, but that's just, you know, it was the right decision. And I think the question, Lars, unless you wanted to come back in on VAR, is why didn't Tottenham turn up until 55 minutes into this football match?
No, I just want to ask, the guy in your five-a-side team or the guy in your Sunday league team who got angry with everyone all the time, was it Antonio Conte?
it wasn't. And actually, you make a good point. We should talk about Conte saying, afterwards, Conte saying, I don't see honesty. This creates a big damage. I hope the club understands this. I think the club has to be strong. I repeat, the situation creates a big damage. It's really unhelpful, right? And we were critical of Klopp when he got really angry. We need to be consistent. Conte got angry, got sent off. But then to come out afterwards and sort of try and invent some sort of conspiracy is just a bit rubbish, I think.
Yeah, it is. We said it before. It's even if the manager has a point, it's damaging and unhelpful. And there's no question it filters down, and that's why referees at grassroots level get as much abuse as they do, and why there's a shortage. But when you're arguing something and you're completely in the wrong, then it's, I think it should be in some way punishable. And Conte is a great man for telling other managers they shouldn't complain and whinge, but he does an awful lot of himself.
Yeah. To the game itself, Lars, you know, Spurs didn't turn up until the second half. There were boos from Spurs fans at half time. Isn't it worth giving it a go in the first half? Like, that is also part of a football match.
Yeah, so they did get sort of better eventually when they panicked. When they panicked, and when I thought Sporting kind of lost their nerve a little bit in the second half, and Ruben Amorim looked like he'd kind of lost the will to live towards the end. That was very, very strange behavior by the Sporting manager, who's otherwise, you know, seems a very talented guy. But I just, there's something about the Antonio Conte sort of plan, which is you sit back, you draw opponents in, you're very aggressive and defensively solid when you do engage with them, and then you kill them on the counterattack. That's like the four-step plan. They're currently only doing two of those steps. Like, they are sitting back correctly. That's very good, yes. They are drawing the opponent in. Very good. But the whole thing about being very solid and aggressive, not really happening. And then on the counterattack, absolutely not happening. And at that point, the four-step plan becomes like a two-step plan, which is not very, it's just not very good. And it's happening week after week after week. I'm not necessarily of the opinion, as are many other Tottenham fans, that they need a more creative midfielder and they need to dominate more. It's just, well, you've appointed Antonio Conte. You're not going to do that. That's not what he does. But they need to do, his plan needs to be better executed. Like, and there is also a question to be raised. Antonio Conte's way of playing necessarily puts a lot of pressure on your defenders, because if you're going to sit back as much as you are, you just will have more situations in a game where defenders have a chance to mess up, basically. there are just more things throughout the 90 minutes where defenders have to solve issues. And I'm not sure Tottenham have enough defenders that you fully trust to not screw up over 90 minutes of football for that to be a good approach to the game. I'm not sure. So I have my doubts over the whole operational concept at the moment. But it is what it is. You've appointed Antonio Conte. He's going to do Antonio Conte things. I just wish they did it better.
Worth saying that Sporting had two brilliant chances in the second half, even when Tottenham were on top. And then Eric Dier has two amazing chances to put them through. And a wonderful moment for Marcus Edwards, right, who started his career at Tottenham. And, you know, this was a huge moment for him. And he took it with that goal. Arguably, Lloris could have done a bit better. I mean, my favourite moment of the game, Barry, was Emerson Royal throwing a no-look pass and smashing it out of play, when actually he could have just played, he could have just passed the ball looking like that. He didn't need to look the other way. It's like, come on, mate. Like, look in the right direction. Like, get the part off.
Anyway, were you not entertained, Max?
I was, actually, to be fair, I was.
Are we entirely certain that this was a no-look pass, like, as a piece of skill, and not just Emerson just not looking in the right direction? Because
it's entirely possible.
Max, you kind of glossed over Lloris there. Is he becoming a bit of a liability for Tottenham? I thought that was a great goal from Marcus Edwards, but he didn't really get a right good hold of it. I thought it was a soft one to let in. And it's, Lloris has been making a lot of mistakes. I actually had to check, because I couldn't think off the top of my head who Spurs' backup keeper was. It's Fraser Foster. And maybe, I think it might be time for him to get a run in the side.
Yeah, possibly. I always feel like Lloris, even though he's like, you know, he's won World Cups and is sort of a decorated footballer, quite often makes mistakes. I don't know, Lars.
Well, that was always the thing about him throughout his career, is that he's been a very good goalkeeper, you know, World Cup winner, all of this, and he's consistently very high in all the sort of shot-stopping metrics and all this sort of stuff. But then he makes three or four howlers a year, but you just kind of get accepted. But the thing is, last sort of year, 18 months, I think I'm right in saying that his overall performance has declined as well. Like, he's not digging them out of as many holes as he used to. And the errors seem to be coming a little bit faster, thicker and faster than they used to. And then I do think if someone has been as faithful a servant to a club as he has been in terms of being there for a very long time, being good for a very long time, you should be, there's some patience should be afforded if you have a down period. But it is a slight concern at the moment, I would say.
So look, Spurs top of the group on 8 points, Sporting have 7, Eintracht Frankfurt have 7 and Marseille have 6. That's because Eintracht Frankfurt beat Marseille 2-1. Lars, who do you think will progress from this group?
I'm starting to worry that Tottenham might not do it. I mean, I'm worried if the sort of, they've hit a terrible run of form at the worst possible moment in terms of the Champions League. Listen, man for man, they're a better team than Marseille. And Marseille have, had this hilariously bad record in the Champions League over a long period of time. So they should be able to go there and win. But it's very hard to look at Spurs and have any confidence in them doing anything right now. So I think there's a very real chance that they mess this up.
Let's go to Group B, where arguably, Nicky, the end of Atleti Leverkusen was more exciting than the end of Spurs Sporting.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely bonkers the way this game ended, because it's 2-2, right? The game is 2-2, and we think we've reached the end of it, as in, like, the full-time whistle goes, you've got the sad shot of Atletico players sort of trudging off, the music comes on in the stadium, like, genuinely, it's the end of the game. And then you find out there's a VAR review. And then the VAR turns out to be a penalty for Atletico, and Atletico need to win the game or they're out, not going through to the last 16. So this is a sort of beyond the last gasp reprieve they've been given. They come on to take a penalty, which Carrasco takes. It's saved. Then the rebound comes to Saul. He heads it onto the bar. So you've already had a penalty save and then the rebound going onto the bar. Then it comes back to another player whose shot is blocked by Carrasco, who took the penalty on its way into the net. So you can't ask for a more dramatic end to a football game than that. I mean, it literally had ended. Atletico were out. Then they came back on and they got 3 bites at not being out. And somehow at the end of it, they were still out.
Lars, it was wildly brilliant, wasn't it?
It was. I was very happy for the Leverkusen goalkeeper, Lukas Radetzky, because he's been on a bit of a weird one this season. He's made some really bad mistakes. But he is a good shot stopper. And I just love he's a profile writer's dream, this guy, because he was actually born in Bratislava, in what was then Czechoslovakia. But as a young child, his family emigrated to Finland because his father played semi-professional volleyball. So they moved to Finland to play semi-professional volleyball, which just isn't a thing that happens to a lot of people. And then he grew up...
Actually, when you break that down, that's a weird sort of, it's not like sitting down with the family going, I've got this great job offer. It's paid millions of pounds. It's like, I can get 50 quid a week to play volleyball in Scandinavia. Shall we go? Yeah, all right.
Yeah, it is a bit of a strange one. So then he grew up in Finland. And he is apparently, by all accounts, like the life and soul of the Finnish national team dressing room. He's a big joker in the dressing room. He's a big beer enthusiast. After they'd won a game, the Finnish national team once, someone in the crowd handed him a pint and he just grabbed it and drank the whole thing. So he's a great character, and he's had a bad season so far for Leverkusen. So seeing him have a great moment made me happy.
The Leverkusen sort of players roared in Carrasco's face, a little bit sort of Keown on Van Nistelrooy at the end of that. I wonder what, Atleti going out, right? I sort of feel like we've been asking this question a lot, Lars, about, is this the end of Simeone's Atleti? Are they a different Atleti? They're no longer the Atleti that we remember. I'm slightly annoyed that we won't have Atleti v Porto with something on it in the last game with Pepe versus all of Atleti. But where are Atleti now?
So I think it seems, you're going to have ask Sid about this at some point, but my impression is that Diego Simeone won't come under serious pressure almost regardless of what happens at the football club because of everything they've been through with him because of the way he's elevated the football club. But it's not the first season now where we look at this squad and say, you have a lot of really good players. Like, why are you not playing better football? There's some really, really good attacking players in this team. One of them being Joao Felix, who just can't get on the field. I mean, whether or not he's lived up to his transfer fee, that's a kind of separate issue. But he is a very talented young man who can do things. And in a game like this, when you absolutely have to win, you've got one whole half of chasing that last goal. You bring in Joao Felix in the 87th minute. Like, what are you afraid of, man? And I'd be enormously frustrated. But again, we talk about there not being patience with managers and all this sort of stuff. I think he's done enough for the club to kind of be entitled to pick his moment of departure and to be almost completely isolated from criticism, because where were they before he came in, right, is a question you can ask. But my God, you get really frustrated with the team sometimes just because of all the quality that's there and you're just not seeing it.
Porto won 4-0 in Bruges in the other game. That's actually the first goals that Bruges have conceded in the Champions League. They've had a brilliant run. They're through, Porto are through, still up for grabs who wins the group, and it is still between Atleti and Leverkusen who get through to the Europa League. I wonder if actually, you know, most teams will be looking at Bruges or Porto and thinking, this is who we want in the last 16, Lars.
It probably is. I think it's great that Bruges have done as well as they have, but you have to be realistic and look at what the field is and think that, yeah. But whereas Porto have this thing of, they pretty much always get out of the group stage and they almost always go out in the first or second round afterwards. I do think you shouldn't be too pleased if you draw Porto. I think that's a meme waiting to happen. If the draw happens and you get Porto and you have a sort of smug club director nodding, yeah, it's fine. Like that's the footballing gods will look at that, and there's enough stuff in this Porto team to trouble quite a few opponents, I think.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Liverpool's win in Amsterdam. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Football Weekly Live is on the 17th of November. Still a few tickets left for Earth in Hackney. Me, Barry, Lars, Ellis, James. Mrs. Rushton, Lars, didn't quite get Lars Sivertsen, but I thought she was close enough. I hadn't told her who was on the live show when I did that video. Are you happy to be Lars Silverton until the live show, or do you
protest? I've been called worse, not by the current Mrs. Rushton, in fairness, but no. And listen, it is a struggle having my name. I'm very frequently mispronounced, but I don't take it personally. I've just learned, for instance, like if you're booking a seat at a restaurant or something, it's just easier to book it in the name of Dave or something to just sort of save time. just kind of tired of spelling my name.
Very, very Aspilicueta of you. So there we go. Me, Barry, Lars, Ellis, James, streamed around the world as well. So wherever you are and wherever you're listening right now, you can watch it. Go to theguardian.com/guardianlive. We are looking forward to seeing you. So look, Napoli were already through. We'll get onto their victory over Rangers in a second. Liverpool needed a point. They got three. They won 3-0 against Ajax. And Barry, Conor McNamara, the commentator, saying, nice touch by Liverpool wearing green in honour of Ireland beating England at the cricket. but look, they rode their luck at the start of this game, and actually then it was quite comfortable.
Yeah, pretty much. Ajax missed two very good chances in before Liverpool scored. Steven Berghaus hit the post when the goal was more or less gaping. Just Alisson to beat. Alisson on his 200th appearance for Liverpool, by the way. And Dusan Tadic had a shot saved by... it was blocked by Trent Alexander-Arnold. And he probably should have scored as well. But and after that, it was pretty comfortable for Liverpool. But not as the match wasn't as comfortable as the scoreline suggests, I suppose.
Michael says, would Barry have scored the Darwin Nunez miss where he hit the post? Where it seemed, I couldn't work out if this miss was actually easier than the Shakhtar one from yesterday. It doesn't look as ridiculous, but because he's the ball's in front of him and he had a lot of net to aim at. Anyway, Barry, what do you reckon?
I probably wouldn't have been in position to miss.
That's very humble of you.
I have to go with the old question. Have I had a pre-season or not?
Let's see if we can get you to do pre-season at Liverpool next year.
Oh, God.
Lars, any thoughts on this game?
I thought it was interesting to see them line up in kind of like a 4-4-2 diamond type of thing, because I think we're all well, I say all. I think some of us are looking very closely at Liverpool at the moment and are kind of intrigued to follow Jurgen Klopp's sort of attempts at figuring this team out, because it's not functioning the way it used to. Players aren't pressing as much as they used to, and that means some of the things they were doing before just aren't working anymore. And there's been a few changes of formation recently, and the latest that they tried now was kind of a diamond shape in midfield with Fabinho as the holding midfielder, Harvey Elliott and Henderson either side of him, and actually Firmino as a kind of a 10. That's what it looked like to me anyway. And I don't think I'd seen that before. And I thought it was interesting. Looked a bit in the first half as if the players weren't super familiar with the whole setup and what they were meant to be doing. But maybe this is a way to get more players into positions on the field where they're comfortable and to cover some of the flaws. I still think against stronger teams, a midfield diamond where your right side is Elliott and Trent Alexander-Arnold is ripe for opponents to be picked off, I wonder. But yeah, the Klopp sort of tactical looking for solutions the thing continues.
It's been such a sort of odd group in terms of the sort of brittleness of teams in a certain way, because Ajax began this group with a 4-0 win over Rangers, and you thought, okay, it's been an interesting group. You know, Liverpool just got thumped. But it's almost just, yeah, sort of an escalating scale of bad defending at times, it's felt like. And Ajax have not been good at the back at all, and that's sunk them. But of course, Liverpool weren't in their game against Napoli either. So yeah, there's this sort of, it's been a strange group with lots and lots of goals, some of them well-earned and brilliant, and also quite a few that just defending hasn't been great.
Yeah, and I mean, Napoli will win the group unless Liverpool win, what, 5-0 or something in the... In that other game, which seems unlikely. Napoli, the highest scorers in this year's Champions League group stage, 20 goals in 5 games. They're only behind PSG, who got 25 in 2017-18, and Bayern Munich, who got 24 in 2019-20. And this is an amazing stat, if it's true. Giovanni Simeone becomes only the second player to score 4 goals in his first 4 Champions League games after Diego Simeone. Is this real?
What?
This is, I mean, I'm blaming producer Silas if it isn't accurate. I don't remember Simeone. I can't imagine Diego Simeone scoring 4 goals in his first 4 Champions League games, but who knows?
That bit does sound unlikely, isn't it? I mean, Giovanni Simeone's introduction to the Champions League has been something magical. I mean, this is a guy I'm sure I talked about at the time, who got a tattoo when he was a teenager, sort of the Champions League tattoo, because he was going to kiss it when he scored his first Champions League goal, which he did. And now, look, he's scoring, it feels like, constantly for them in the Champions League. And I've probably banged this drum already plenty on this podcast, but Napoli's success this season is a great triumph of good recruiting, of good summer planning. And they've gone from a team that was completely reliant on Victor Osimhen up front, who's brilliant, so a good player to rely on, but completely reliant on him. And then when he wasn't there, suffered this huge drop off, to a team who can now go, well, when Osimhen isn't there, they had Raspadori scoring goals in the league, playing with this false nine that was quite a different style, like genuinely changed their shape, to here we are in the Champions League and we can keep throwing Giovanni Simeone on, who keeps, despite being not that tall, winning headers, getting on the end of crosses in the middle, is a real sort of able to fill that, I guess, quite classic number nine role in a way that can be quite surprising at times. He's been brilliant, and he's the third of their strikers. This team is really... I don't know. I don't know what the limit is for this Napoli team. I'm really excited to see where they go in the second half of the season in the Champions League. Of course, with everything this season, I think we all have to put a great big sort of warning stamp on everything, which is the World Cup's going to happen and everything's going to look different afterwards. But right now, I look at this Napoli team and I think, who are they scared of in this competition? I don't think they should be scared of anyone.
Diego Simeone did, in fact, score twice in his first 2 games in the Champions League in 1996. For Atleti versus, initially scored twice against Steaua Bucharest, and then he scored twice against Widzew Łódź, or Łódź, I think is the pronunciation of that.
I do have an update on the stat, which makes it slightly less impressive. He becomes only the second Argentinian to score 4 goals in his first 4 Champions League games. But even still,
that does narrow it down a bit.
It's nice at Christmas, on Christmas Day, they can both celebrate those, you know, those stats, and at least Simeone can be involved by going to watch his son in the Champions League, can't he? How's Tanguy Ndombele doing for Napoli?
I mean, he's doing okay. He's kind of been assigned in that midfield as the backup to Anguissa, which I find a bit odd because they're not that similar in terms of the way they play. And he certainly doesn't have the enterprise of Anguissa. He certainly doesn't have the ability, I would say, to beat his man and to carry the ball forward as effectively as Anguissa does. But he's doing all right. He's certainly got a role as I guess almost the fourth man in the three-man midfield, like someone who's going to rotate in, who's going to be getting games. But he's not tearing up trees. He's been a useful squad player so far.
He's not tearing up trees, but he did spank a shot from distance off the woodwork last night.
Barry, a word on Rangers. I mean, it's similar situation to Celtic. As in fact, Celtic showed promise,
not.
Didn't they?
<It's> more...
It isn't. Celtic showed promise. You know, Rangers, it's just a step beyond them, isn't it?
It's been pitiful, to be honest. And, you know, I get budgets and all that, but they've just been walloped week in, week out. It can't be good for any morale, in team morale, fan morale. And if they lose next week, it's between them and Victoria Plzeň, who can also get the title for worst ever group stage performance. So but they can also still qualify for the Europa League.
So it's true.
It's not good enough. I give Celtic a C+. I'd a D for Rangers, maybe even a D-.
Yeah, so look, they did turn up for all the games. You know, they didn't flunk off, did they? They didn't skive. They are 5 defeats from 5, a goal scored, 1 conceded, 19. Victoria Plzeň are 5 defeats from 5, scored 3, conceded 20. So yeah, so Rangers with a bit of work to do to avoid that particular wooden spoon. Victoria Plzeň bottom of that group, which has been won by Bayern. Inter coming second, Barcelona third, and Barcelona out of the Champions League second year in a row. Let's talk about Inter first. Rob says, what is it about Inter Milan and restoring tired old former Premier League players to their former glory like a Lombardian repair shop? Which is a great question. Mkhitaryan, Dzeko, Lukaku, all on the score sheet.
Yeah, well, of course, Mkhitaryan was at Roma last season where he won the Europa Conference League with Mourinho, and he's sort of been an extra body for this Inter midfield this season. Edin Dzeko is... I really like Edin Dzeko. I think he's someone who perhaps always got a little bit underestimated in his career and not given the credit he was due. And yeah, look, he's 36 years old. He's not going to be... the best player in the world or something, but he's a really useful player to have. And he really is very selfless. He's very, he's a real enabler in that Inter team. And he's not first choice, right? When Lautaro and Lukaku were there, that's their first choice attack, but it's a pretty nice option to have. And I don't know, I was really impressed with Inter in this game. I know it's just Plzeň who have been dreadful, but I think there's been so many times, and Inzaghi talked about it after the game, when Inter specifically, and probably Italian clubs in general, have gone into these sorts of games late in a Champions League group stage, and you'd think, okay, well, they should control this from here, and they fluff their lines, they've stuffed it up. But last night they were totally in control of this game. There was never a sniff of anything going wrong, really. And yeah, there was a few really good performances in there. Dzeko was one of them. I thought Di Marco, the fullback, and his crosses were really, really strong. Mkhitaryan obviously got the goal. It was a good performance from Inter, and I think, I know that it's easy to sort of go, oh yeah, it's Victoria Plzeň, but honestly, very, very few people in Italy, with how Inter started this season, gave them any hope of getting out of this group. So to do it with a game to spare and to knock Barcelona out, it's big news, actually. It's big news in Italy.
And actually, Lukaku, he's been injured for a while. It was such a Lukaku goal, wasn't it? And given his sort of trials and tribulations at Chelsea, you just really hope that it works for him.
Yeah, it was interesting listening to Andrea Onana, the goalkeeper, after the game, and he was like asked about Lukaku, and he almost shrugged off and said, "Well, I don't know, I'm not surprised by that. Lukaku's Lukaku. Of course, he's going to do that." What excited me was seeing this, how the stadium got energized, seeing him back out there, how the fans responded to him, and he responded to the fans. And there is this sort of dynamic of Lukaku at Inter that it's an unfinished story, right? It was an unfinished story when he went to Chelsea, and it feels like he's come back there with this desire to write another chapter. And yeah, it's nice to see him out there and getting a chance to do it again.
Tom says, should Real Madrid petition to drop into the Europa League so they can play elite teams like Barcelona and Juventus every week? Yeah, Barca, they were relying on Pilsen. Obviously, that wasn't something to rely on, was it, Lars? And Sid's written a great match report just saying how flat they were. And Bayern were brilliant in this game, or were ruthless, I guess.
Yeah, they're really, really well set up to play on the counter this season, Bayern, because they've got so much speed and trickery going forward. And whereas occasionally in the Bundesliga, we've seen teams kind of sit deep and they struggle to find the openings. But of course, against Barcelona, that was not a problem because Barcelona were defending really high up the pitch. And they were not doing that very basic thing of, like, you have to have pressure on the man in possession. If there isn't pressure, you have to drop off. That was not happening. So Barcelona, as a Bayern, were just picking them off on the counter. And I do think, like, injury plays a part here because no Christensen, no Araujo. Pique has obviously declined maybe faster than people were anticipating. But having spent all this money, it is wild that they go into a big Champions League game with, like, Marcus Alonso at center half. And it's like, how does that happen? I mean, surely you've mortgaged your whole thing. Like, presumably the idea was to build a squad where this wouldn't have to happen. Like, this seems very strange to me. Hector Bellerin not having a great night either. Yeah, it just didn't look very good. And I think it's really weird, the story that Xavi brought them in to watch the Pilsen game first. Which I guess is the idea was that if Pilsen could have done it, then they'd be really fired up for the game. And if they didn't, then it didn't really matter anyway. But I mean, it was never going to work, was it? And it's kind of like watching them. They watch their own failure first, you know. They have 90 minutes to contemplate what a mess they're in. And then off you go to play against Bayern. I mean, that's not a very strong motivating tactic, I don't think. Seems very weird. And yeah, Listen, it would be disingenuous to suggest that they're not a better team than they were at this point last season. They clearly are, right? But you have to ask yourself, they've pulled all these levers, and for what? Like, they're going to end up going out. Well, they've gone out early in the Champions League like last season, and there's a fairly good chance they finish second in La Liga like last season. So what have you actually achieved with all this reckless spending is the question that springs to my mind, certainly.
A wonderful pass from Serge Gnabry for Sadio Mane's goal. I mean, it's absolutely inch perfect, laces sort of on the volley. What a wonderful kick of a football that was. And then Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting scored the second. Kieran says, can the panel please spend a minute on the career of Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting? How did he ever end up at Stoke? And really, how good is he? He's won everything by the Champions League in France and Germany. I need expert opinions on how to feel about him as a footballer. How should we feel about Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting?
Well, my recollection is, and I'm far from an expert, this is far from an expert opinion on Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting, but I didn't even think he was that good at Stoke. And remember being absolutely astounded when PSG came in for him. Yeah, and I'd just being baffled that he'd rocked up at PSG when they were making all these marquee signings. And I haven't followed his career too closely since then, but yeah, I wouldn't imagine Stoke could probably afford him because they've got, their owners have so much money, but he probably won't be rocking up there anytime soon again.
I don't think he's started more than 10 games in a season since he left Stoke, so he's not been a main man anywhere. He's just been...
What a life, what a life.
Is he the modern day Christian Karimbu? Because remember, he played for all the big clubs. He must be one of the most decorated players in the world, in the history of the game. And it wasn't particularly good. I mean, he wasn't terrible, obviously, but...
So it feels like, to me, like he feels like the outfield version of the old third keeper. You know, like he's very much the kind of Rob Green of, you know, of the outfield player. Well, it's a harder thing to do as an outfield player. You might actually have to play occasionally, but, like, you know, he did all right. Scored at the Nou Camp. Can't knock it, can you? I think he missed a really easy chance. It was either for Stoke or PSG. And so you were just like, I think maybe it was at PSG. And then you were all just like, he's there? What on earth is it? How has that happened? But, you know, Adam Crowd from The Athletic tweeting, that's 5 of the 12 teams originally signed up to the Super League. Barca, Juve, Atleti, Manchester United, Arsenal, not in the Champions League knockout rounds. AC Milan and Spurs also in the balance going into the final round. Had quite a few questions. Kieran again saying, look, Barry and some others on the panel have maintained they could easily predict 13 or 14 of the 16 teams into the knockout stages. Did everybody know that Barca, Juve, Atleti, Ajax weren't making it out except me. Is this season a positive endorsement for the group stages? Have you been engaged by the group stages, Baz?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it depends on how you look at it, I suppose. Are you judging games on their individual merit or just the group stages as a whole? Obviously, there were dead rubbers this week, there are dead rubbers next week, and or the next game week, and they're a bit of a waste of everyone's time. But yeah, I wouldn't have predicted that those big teams would have gone out.
Nicky, a word on Juve, who I think you said last time are garbage, and they appear to still be garbage.
Yeah, I don't know what there is to say about Juventus at the moment. They are not interesting to watch. I suppose, well, that's slightly unfair, isn't it? Because they got interesting to watch right at the end of the game when they decided to send on all of their kids, and actually suddenly it was like, oh, hang on, you've got some young players who maybe you should give a chance to. I have nothing positive to say about Max Allegri. I think his time is up there. He's become someone who's got, it's that classic story of one in Italy, they call me yesterday, he's got that, the reheated soup, he's gone back there and it isn't good. And the club is in an incredibly awkward spot because he's on €7 million a year and they can't afford to fire him. But it's also, of course, this classic Juventus position to say, well, we don't make a decision until the end of the season. But right now, it's bad. And I think one of the things that's most damning of it is just the lack of character being shown by the senior players in the team. The things as simple as the number of tackles they're making. They're barely making tackles in games. And you think, if you can't get that minimum level of effort, if you can't get that minimum amount of commitment from people, then what's your platform? Having said that, laying it all at Allegri's feet is wrong. The club has been chaotically run, I would say, probably ever since Beppe Marotta left. And that was sort of this perhaps moment of when the adult leaves the room and the kids are allowed to run the show, and it isn't run well. And Ronaldo is the great folly, the one that's going to get pointed out as the sort of most obvious thing. But in general, squad recruitment for years has been this chaotic approach of, oh, this person's available and we think it's a nice deal. And what you've ended up with in this season is a lot of that money's been spent on players who aren't even there, like Paul Pogba, who was supposed to be the big transformative signing of the summer and isn't on the pitch. I do think the end of this game gives you some things that are exciting. I definitely do want to see more of Samuel Illing Jr., who's, of course, this English player who's popped up, I think, even on Italian radars, it feels a bit out of nowhere, and has played really well, I thought, in his cameo in this game, and had a nice cameo, very short one against Empoli as well. But overall, the trajectory of this Juventus team right now is a bit grim.
Speaking of Ronaldo, Nicky, is there any truth at all to the rumours that Napoli might be about to commit a great folly by signing him in January?
I would say never say never, because it's Aurelio De Laurentiis and he is a filmmaker and he has made no sort of, he's not in his life and in his career been one of sort of stepping away from a chance to drum up some headlines. But I also don't expect it at the moment. I think Napoli are quite aware that they've got together a group that is genuinely capable of achieving something. And the feeling in that group right now is quite something. And so I wouldn't expect it. I think the other thing to say with De Laurentiis, he's a showman. He's done ridiculous things all of his career. He's unveiled players in lion masks on yachts. He's done things to get your attention. But actually the one thing he hasn't done is blow his money. Napoli have been consistently one of the most fiscally well-run ships in Serie A. He tends to turn a profit. So unless he sees very good reasons for the bottom line for signing Ronaldo, I don't think it'll happen.
Yeah, I remember when, did he once present a player wearing, I remember it now. So he presented a player at a press conference, De Laurentiis, wearing like a lion's mask. And then the mask was taken off and it was Gökhan İnler, which was that's a slight anticlimax, really, I guess. It's like, wow, we've signed this lion and it's Gökhan İnler, who's just kind of an okay-ish central midfielder. Very, very strange behavior.
It's getting Lee Catamol in a lion mask, isn't it?
Which is, I mean, ironically, what we did for a live show once. I mean, you made the big joke about the last guest being to be announced and then the guest was brought on onto stage wearing a horse's head, so no one saw who it was. And then the horse's head was removed, and it was me, which I think was very similar to the Gökhan Endler presentation.
Sounds like a better idea at the time. The people who bought tickets about 10 minutes ago are probably going, if that's the sort of crap we're going to get,
I mean, the crowd at the time seemed to enjoy it, but they may have been very drunk. I'm not quite sure. on Ronaldo, I mean, him going to Napoli, I thought he would be leaving United because he wants to play football and not be on the bench. I mean, if he goes to Napoli... like, he's clearly not better than Victor Osimhen. I'd probably pick both Raspadori and Giovanni Simeone ahead of him because you get people who work for the team at least. So, I mean, he wouldn't... I don't think he'd... never mind all the dressing room dynamics and him sort of exploding the good atmosphere and everything. He's not getting into the team if everyone's fit.
All right, that'll do for part two. Nikki, you have to leave us.
I do. I'm sorry. I've got a train to run for.
Absolute outrage, but that's fine. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
Me, Barry Lars, will stick about, look ahead to the games in the Premier League and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We are nominated for the Football Supporters Association Podcast of the Year. Go to the fsa.org.uk. There's a big page that says awards. Click on that link. You'll go to a SurveyMonkey page. Click Football Weekly under Podcast of the Year. You know, you get all these for nothing. Do something so Barry at the awards can have a nice time. And when I land in the UK, I can turn my phone on to some happy news. And there are lots of other people who you will know. Robin Cowan, David Squires, Barney Ronay, Susie Rack. The warm-up on Talk Sport feels slightly rude to ask for nominations for that while we're here. But Barry... sod it. Why not?
Why not?
We'd like to win both and then we will shut up about it. Or not, depending on how we get on. Chelsea won 8-0 against Vlasnia in an Albanian team who've never been managed by Unai Emery despite almost having Villa in their name. Sam Kerr scored 4. Pinilahara got a hat-trick. All the details of that and everything's going on in the WSL on the Guardian Women's Football Weekly. 3 weeks of the Premier League to go before... the World Cup, the fixtures this weekend. I don't know if any of them jump out at you, Barry. Leicester, Man City, the early one. For some reason, I feel Leicester might do something in that game.
Well, it's possible. I don't think they will, but, you know. I don't see it myself, but stranger things have happened.
Maybe it's more hope than expectation. Yes, Lars?
Leicester in their last two games have scored 6 goals from 5 shots on target.
So they're efficient.
If they continue with this sort of efficiency, I mean, this could be bad for City. Don't necessarily even need to concede a shot for Leicester to score. Football is a really silly game sometimes. All the struggles Leicester have had and all the bad results and Brendan Rodgers being under pressure. And then they've had 2 wins to really turn everything around. But it's been like that bit in Indiana Jones where the man is like twiddling his sword around and Harrison Ford just shoots him. I mean, that was really what happened in Wolves Leicester, because Wolves like had 21 shots to Leicester's 5, and Leicester ended up winning 4-0. It was ridiculous.
I think if I was going to pick an upset, I'd go maybe Bournemouth to beat Spurs or Brighton to beat Chelsea.
Yeah, Graham Potter going back to the Amex, see what reception he gets. Liverpool playing Leeds, a late kickoff on Saturday, 7:45 in the evening. It's an odd time, you know, that's when, you know, it's strictly time, isn't it, for everyone? Although, you know, after my Coldplay admission, Barry, I'm not going to admit to watching Strictly. I've never got into that. Now, the Socceroos, Australia, the first FIFA World Cup side to release a collective statement of protest against Qatar's human rights record, calling for effective remedy for migrant workers, the decriminalisation of same-sex relationships. The video message was delivered line by line by 16 players, supported by the broader Australian playing group, been followed up by Football Australia, saying the suffering felt by workers and their families has been caused by the tournament cannot be ignored. It's a strong statement, isn't it, Barry? I know we've been doing some specials that are going to come out before and during the World Cup. So it is sort of really on our minds at the moment and should be on everyone's minds before we go into the tournament. It is, from my point of view, it's great to see a team actually talking to everybody, doing their research and coming out with something this strong.
Yeah, and it was very balanced, measured, thoughtful approach, very carefully worded. They said, you know, they alluded to the progress that has been made with regards to the abolition of the kafala system, but those reforms aren't necessarily being implemented properly. They said that everyone should be in a union, whether they're footballers or builders, in migrant workers in Qatar. And they said that they don't have all the answers. And they connected labor rights with gay rights and proposed solutions. And we recorded a special yesterday, which will be coming out at some point before the World Cup, in which it was pointed out FIFA have a legal obligation to recompense these workers who, you know, bereaved families of migrant workers who died. So, yeah, but I was looking at the statement on Twitter, and one of the first comments I saw underneath was that it was woke virtue signaling bullshit. So, you know, you can't win. And then a lot of people were saying, oh, but you're still going to the World Cup. Why don't you pull out of it? Why don't you boycott it? And, you know, I don't think that's helpful. But it was great to see them do it. And I imagine in the whole corridors of power in a lot of international federations of teams that are participating in the World Cup finals, they'll now be going, oh, God, we better do something. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
Yeah, and look, it's brave to be the first, right? And what you hope is the FA, the Welsh FA, all the other associations around the world look at this because, you know, it as a collective, it means much more, right? If just Australia do it, then, you know, Qatar will go, do you know what? We've probably got away with that.
I think if the Aussies end up being the only team to do it, I can look forward to seeing a lot of bad decisions going against them in their group state matches.
Saying Antonio Conte will be talking about honesty again. We shall see, won't we? Adam says, question for Lars. My friend is moving to Stockholm in January and has chosen Djurgården as his adopted team. Has he made a wise decision?
So it's hard to answer that without knowing stuff like where in town, because there's like local geography reasons.
Right.
I think my instinct would be maybe personally to be a little bit more drawn towards Hammarby, but Djurgården are a very well-supported team, and I'm sure he'll be very happy, but it does matter a little bit where in town you're from, I think.
Gareth says, how many goals will Posh beat Cambridge by in the Cambridgeshire derby? It's the first one in the league for maybe two decades. Peterborough versus Cambridge United. It's the biggest derby in world football at London Road. I'm absolutely terrified. Like they're better, they've got a bigger wage bill. They're better players than us. They're doing better in the league. But we are, you know, we are the mighty Cambridge United, you know. It's... please don't. Please win. Just please win. Dion scored a hat trick in a 5-1 win, and that's what I'm hoping happens this Saturday. Although he doesn't play for us still, but you know, get him back for this one. Yeah, I should be more bullish about it. But yeah, I'm nervous, Gareth, and not made the best team win. I hope we shithouse you like we did Wickham. M says, a moment for Neil Cugley, resigned as manager of Folkestone Invicta. 1,299 games in charge, his 26th season, making him the longest serving manager in the pyramid. When football at the top can be quite cynical, it's people like Neil who remind you how delightful the game can be. Good luck to you, Neil, in whichever club you decide to go to, or maybe if you decide to hang up your boots or your clipboard, that is some stint, isn't it? And Paul says, after Max's Coldplay bombshell yesterday, has anyone checked in on John Bruin? Listen, I've no time for music snobs here. You can like what you like and enjoy what you enjoy. And, you know, it's a game of opinions.
I dare you to say that when Bruin is on the Zoom.
I'll do my best. That'll do for today. Cheers, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Executive producer is Max Sanderson. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.